Ed isn't allowed to comment on the Bake Off
anybody
franchise.
From Bake Off. Yeah. No.
Really? Okay, we're calling the podcast off. I'm just going to keep saying untruths about Mary Berry until he cracks. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast which opens up the dormant fridge of life, peeks past the mould, pickle stains and laminated cheese slices to pick up a packet of ham 2 weeks past its sell-by date and lay it on stale hobis as a scumbag entree. We're here to celebrate the grizzled, grumpy and ghoulish side of life, championing the broken, the failing and the sometimes downright unsanitary. Each week, me, my co-host, and our guest will uncover an example of some of the world's worst subjects and turn them over the white-hot charcoal grill of our judgment to see which is the absolute pits. And joining me, as ever, is the lumpy pint of red top to my gooey coagulating blue top, Barry McStay.
Oh, yeah, I've been meaning to lose weight, but now you've broadcast that, I've real incentive.
No, mate, you're skimmed. It's all right.
But oh, no, that sounds wrong. Already that sounds wrong.
That is a way...
I don't want to be semi-skimmed.
It's a problem a lot of men have.
It's such a weird beginning already. We never managed to start these in any professional manner.
Just, World's Worst Podcast, mate, yeah. It's how it works. Just be thankful I didn't refer to you as almond milk.
Like, God, I hate those pricks.
Yeah.
What's this week's milk made from? Oh, it's avocado milk. But it's literally, milk is from mammals, guys. You can't stop finding food stuff to make milk from.
I don't know, but avocado breasts.
Yeah, green with a weird lumpy bit in the middle of it.
Mate,
I mean, it's been a while, but as far as I can remember, breasts don't look like that. Or shouldn't,
unless they're on a Dr. Seuss creature. Oh my God, I wonder if there's Dr. Seuss porn out there. There inevitably will be.
To the internet.
No. There's not enough time because this podcast will turn into you and me narrating Dr. Seuss porn, which is a great idea for a podcast.
Oh, I really like it on a train. I really love it on a plane. Oh, God.
So we should introduce our guest.
Green unfertilized eggs and ham. Sorry.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Well played. And that's the end of the podcast. sitting rather uncomfortably to our right and left as we talk absolute bobbins.
I would have
milk.
Liked us to keep talking for like 10 minutes and see how long Ed could have stayed.
Oh, mate, that we totally need to do that as a sweepstake on future pod shows. From now on, we're just going to see how long we can go back and forth and completely blank out our guests.
Yeah, no, I should probably break the tension.
Yeah,
our guest this week is a baker and food writer who, after studying politics at university, entered and won the very first series of a little-known TV show called The Great British Bake Off. It'll never work. He's the author of 3 cookbooks, pops up on TV, including on Sunday Brunch, The Alan Titchmarsh Show, and QVC, and contributes to several publications, including BBC Good Food, Delicious, and Waitrose Kitchen. His website, thebojwhobakes.co.uk, is full of amazing recipes, and his podcast, Stir the Pot, sees him and his guests talk about the food they love. So, obviously, given his degree in politics, we've asked him to talk about the world's worst government. Not really. Here to talk about the world's worst bakers, it's the boy who bakes, Ed Kimber.
Hello.
Hi, Ed.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. What do you think about this weird milk craze?
I really like oat milk.
Well, get
it's
out.
It's really tasty because it tastes of oats. I don't like any of the others, really.
Right.
But I love oat milk. But not in everything because it splits and curdles
and
does
weird
things.
Really weird because it never goes off. Like, those milks just don't go off. They just sit in fridges.
Well, oats will kind of slightly change because it will start to ferment a little bit. But oat milk tastes really good. If you like
milk.
That kind of oaty flavour. But, yeah, not in natural tea. In tea, it's grim because it kind of, like, separates and you get this grim...
Is it okay to bake with all of those?
Yeah, great.
There's no difference, really.
It depends what you're using it for. But, yeah, generally, it's great. Yeah. But, yeah, some of them just don't have any flavour. My boyfriend loves rice milk, and I think it's just gross.
My favourite thing, though, with all the almond milk and oat milk, is the first time I ever experienced it was I was at a mate's house, and we'd had a couple of joints, and he went, oh, do you want a cup of tea? Sure. we made the tea and he poured the milk in and it started to separate and swirl. Yeah, and I lost myself in the eye of the universe for hours on end.
Hypnotised by oat milk.
Mate, it was amazing. It's that is a stoner's biography. Hypnotised by oat milk.
It's a massive Scientology plot.
Yeah.
The big spinning eye.
It's
that's what it is.
Everything a Scientology
plot. Oat milk. Oh, God. Every podcast episode we're recording at the moment seems to spawn a new conspiracy theory. This week's one. You've heard it here first, guys. Oat milk and almond milk is a Scientology plot.
Do you know what? I think that there are right-wing Christian of evangelicals that would believe that.
Probably.
Because I'm sure
the
that...
devil's work.
Yeah, the veganism's definitely the devil's work.
Yeah.
I mean, veganism is
Well, you see,
work.
Vegan has that five letters. Vegan has five letters in it, as does the word Satan.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure.
I mean, I don't think the Westboro Baptist Church are tuning into a podcast with two gay guys and a Jew.
I think they are. Think I think that's them. Their main listening. Yeah.
And we'll take any listeners wherever they're from.
Will we?
Sure.
I will. It's
sure.
fine.
Okay. We look forward to the reviews.
One star. God hates fags.
Yeah. We always ask our guests, as you're aware, what do you are the worst at in the world, Ed? So
that would just be my memory.
Really?
I have, according to my friends, I have a terrible memory. I think my long-term memory is really good, but my short-term memory is shocking. Really?
Ed,
I'm
I hate
really
to break it
bad.
To you, we've already asked you what you were worst at in the world.
No, my memory is, like, terribly, terribly bad, and it seems to be getting worse. I'm slightly worried I have some mind-numbing disease, but it's fine. It's fine.
Has it caused any serious embarrassments?
No, I forget names really badly. Yeah. And I think I have a really visual memory, so until I see something, it will not stay in my head whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I don't remember any of my boyfriend's friends' names yet.
I've been introduced to a friend of my brother-in-law.
Oh, how many times?
Four times.
You can't
Every
ask anymore.
Every time I go, it's really nice to meet you. She goes, yeah, we definitely met like the last time.
You see, because of my job, I meet an awful lot of people, and that happens to me all the time. Yeah. So I've stopped saying, nice to meet you. I say that annoying thing of, great to see you, because it's a little, it's so wanky, but it's good enough to most people, because they're like, oh, I don't know if that's, is that, but it just covers me a little bit.
Do you do that code thing with your...
Yes.
Where
I
you
do,
go,
yeah.
If someone comes up to you, and clearly your partner, you don't know who they are. I'll go to my husband. Oh, do you know my husband?
Yeah.
And he'll go, hi. Sorry, what was your name? Yeah. So then they'll say it to him.
Into like work parties and say, if I don't introduce you to someone, it means I can't remember. So don't do that thing of like, oh, well, hi, I'm just let it set. It's fine.
You've got to have a mind palace full of all of these people you meet. Just a mind palace where there's a garden party going on in the mind palace.
I'm no Sherlock.
You should charge, though. If you meet that many people, charge them for entry to the mind palace.
Yeah, that's true. And obviously the catering in your mind palace will be delicious.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't bring you anything.
Yeah, well, I was going to say. I mean, to be fair, you probably get that every bloody TV or interview thing you do.
Well, not just anything. Like, even I go to a friend's house, there's a look of, where's the cake or dessert or anything. I made my own damn birthday cake this week. Like, come on. It was for my website, so it's fine, but... we went to the pub, and my friends bought me, like, the cheapest, nastiest Victoria sponge you could ever have. And my friend wanted us to blow it out again because she didn't get a picture. And then about 15, like, really drunk people in the pub were, like, pointing and going, why are they doing it again? Because you have to do it more than once. It's very important.
Are you allowed just, like, settle for a cheap...
Yeah, I don't give a crap.
Denise de France.
Well, that's a level I won't approach. No,
Have to be professionally snobby about what baked goods you eat now?
Some of my friends reckon I'm super, super snobby, which is probably true, but I'm not snobby to the point where I wouldn't eat crap. Like, one of my friends is a chocolatier, and he says all the time, you know, what's your favourite, like, candy? And he's like, oh, I love a Kit Kat. I'm like, well, you're like the world's best chocolatier. And so I have no problem, like, going outside of my standards. I just have these specific standards. But it's certain things like coffee I'm super snobby about.
Yeah.
Chocolate, because it's one of the main things I work with. But I also, like, a pack of crisps is delicious, you know. Sometimes a crappy cake from a supermarket tastes like childhood, so you can't say no to it. I have no problems.
Tastes like childhood. What does oat milk taste like?
Tastes like yoga mums.
That's just where I live.
That's a lovely new suburb. Yoga mums, northwest London.
It basically is. Literally, like, all I see when I work, because I work from home, is prams, kids, and then people carrying yoga mats. It's like, yeah.
Is your home defence system... just a series of custard pies baked to the highest level possible.
You imagine he lives in sort of a Home Alone style.
I absolutely am. And I just thought, you know, if the yummy mummies are pissing you off, you can just fire off a 21 pie salute into the prams, into the mummies.
Well, weirdly, I try and give recipes and stuff away to my neighbours because, you know, I work with cake every day, so I don't want to eat all of it.
What you need to do is invest in the yoga. Because by feeding your neighbours, you're then going to make them need to go to yoga.
Yeah, there's like...
Yeah, you need to talk to someone in the gym.
Oh,
right?
Mate, that's dark stuff. That's like someone from Shell Oil investing in an oil cleanup company.
Yeah.
And just the vicious cycle.
Yeah, but they've done that.
Yeah,
they've 100% done that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hope you're listening, Shell.
Mate, they share accommodation with Westboro Baptist Church.
In hell.
In hell, yeah.
Is that slanderous? Are we allowed to say that?
Fuck Shell.
Yeah, fuck Shell.
Also, thank you for making my car work. Obviously, since we've got a bloody bake-off winner here, we decided to talk about the world's worst baker. It's Candice, isn't it? It's definitely Candice.
Oh, no. Whoa.
I couldn't help myself. I couldn't help myself. She's really very good.
Ed isn't allowed to comment on the bake-off.
On anybody
franchise.
From bake-off, yeah. No.
Really? Okay, we're calling the podcast off. I'm just going to keep saying untruths about Mary Berry until he cracks.
She's not on the show anymore. It's
oh, that's
no, she,
true.
No, she's not.
She is still,
she's
not. Oh, no, she's abandoned
no, she's
yeah.
the one that left. Yeah.
She has, what I heard about Mary Berry is that she wears long-sleeved shirts to hide her sailor tattoos.
Well, she does like a drink. So,
during filming?
Yeah. During filming, she basically, the more booze you put in a cake, the better it would do, for
yeah,
sure.
That's common knowledge.
Yeah, totally. I mean, yeah.
Here's a question. Having done Bake Off with Mel and Sue, would you prefer to have them staring over your shoulder or Sandy Toxvig staring under your elbow? And Noel Fielding.
Noel Fielding looking at the cake from 3 miles away through a telescope.
through a lithograph. And Theodolite.
I loved Sue and Mel. Now, when we originally signed up to the show, no one was attached to it apart from Mary. And then when we found out that Sue and Mel were doing it, everybody was really surprised and kind of confused because up until that point, no one had done a food show that wasn't a food person.
Yeah, yeah.
And so everyone thought, nah, it won't work. It'll be terrible. Which is why I think Sandy and Noel may have a chance at doing it. But I prefer to have Sue and Mel, for sure.
They seem very supportive.
They're really sweet, and actually, they're just nice to chat to.
Yeah.
They would just hang around the whole time,
yeah.
just actually interacting, even when you weren't on camera. So it was nicer for that, for
my
sure.
My favourite story with them is if someone was having a really tough time and was having a bit of a meltdown, then they would just come over and swear loads on camera so it wouldn't make the edit. Yeah.
Well, we figured out really early on that if you... because you've got a mic on the whole time, even if there's no cameras or nothing in the tent, if you swear because something's gone wrong, a camera will appear in front of your face within seconds because they're listening in all the time. So we started doing the opposite. So we refused to say anything if something went wrong. But if something went really well, you go, shit. And a camera would come and you go, hello, hi, the editor's great. Because you basically didn't want to get your crappy bits in it. So
To business. Barry, you're going to tell us your choices for the world's worst baker.
Well, I did some baking research. And you know the phrase baker's dozen?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know, for people at home, a dozen is 12, a baker's dozen is 13.
Yes.
And there was a law passed called the Assize of Bread and Ale under Henry III. This is in 1266. Which said that bakers and brewers could be flogged, fined, and pilloried if they came up short serving bread or ale.
I am
so,
totally fine with that, by
the
way.
I mean, I think it's a
what
very
a flogging.
Fair thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was based on the weight of a thing. If you were not including an extra bun to make up for the numbers, it was to make up for the weight of something in a sack, so they'd sell an extra one of whatever the thing
case.
Was just to make sure. Which is called Vantage Loaf or Inbred.
Nobody wants the inbred loaf. Nobody wants it.
So that law was basically the basis of weights and measurements for about 600 or 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Because it's the reason why we've basically had the same size of bread loaf for centuries. A loaf of bread was established as being a pound in 1822, and then it was 14 ounces after the war due to rationing and made a bit smaller. Decimalisation came in, so it was changed to 400 grams. But from the 70s, it's been 400 grams until about 10 years ago, 2008, an EU directive said. You can. I also read this article about this in the Telegraph, so you can imagine what the comment on it was.
We will have none of this for next year.
The Telegraph said an EU directive abolished up to 800 years of British history when saying that bread could be sold in different measurements as opposed to 400s or multiples of 400. Then I thought of the nursery rhyme 4 and 20 blackbirds as well. That one.
Yeah, yeah,
yep.
Think about some pie. Baked a pie. Genuine thing, guys. They used to bake pies with birds in them.
With like real live birds, and then they cut them and they would fly out. Yeah,
yeah. They build basically a massive pie dish with which would be hollow inside, and they'd have a sort of a removable lid on it, or a lid you could break into quite easily. And they'd put songbirds in them, whether it be thrushes or larks or starlings or blackbirds. And when they break it open, the flock would fly out and be a big theatrical thing. And apparently medieval chefs were quite competitive at these feasts and wanting to make a big spectacle. That's why you'd have these sort of like peacock feathers all over things and impressive.
Well, it wasn't actually the chefs, it was the people they worked for, because it was all a status thing. So there's a chef called Antonin Carême, who's seen as like the first celebrity chef. He travelled all around Europe working for like the richest people, and he created these incredible like cityscapes over tables. His stuff is incredible, but he's like the father of pastry in Europe. And he made the most insane things of sugar, and like the more ridiculous it could be, the better he could charge for his work.
That's amazing, because they build a sort of a scaffolding inside the thing to make this pie stand up, and then they'd have a trap door in the base and they'd shove the birds in it at the last second as they wheel it in. But Heston Blumenthal, remember he did that series about like recreating ancient meals? He did Heston's Medieval Feast about 10, 12 years ago. And firstly, he discovered that blackbirds are protected in the UK. You can't use blackbirds, so he used pigeons. And then he discovered pigeons quite tough to encourage them to just fly on command. He got homing pigeons and put the cages for the homing pigeons in the roof above where the diners were, so that when they took the lid off, the birds would see the cages and fly straight up to their cage. Of course, putting pigeon cages right above dining area. So in the episode, they open it up and the birds fly up, and one of them promptly shits on the head of one of his guests, Chef Andre Oliver, who's now going to be replacing...
She has a restaurant right by my house.
Yeah, she's going to be replacing Prue Leith on the Great British Menu, because Prue Leith is going to do Bake Off. Birds fly up, shit on her head.
And she's bald as well, so that would be really obvious.
Oh, also, 1626, King Charles I, his pet dwarf emerged from a cake.
Well, that's just how he was born. I've always wondered.
I'm not from woman born. King Charles had a pet dwarf called Geoffrey Hudson, who sort of climbed out of a pie wearing a pretty suit and bowed to the Queen at a banquet in 1626. And she was so besotted with him, he became sort of her confidant and a companion. She was so impressed by this.
I really love it if somewhere else in history there was like something similar had happened, but instead the little person had come out of the dwarf and then stabbed the Queen. It would be like the most amazing assassin, stabbed her with a blackbird.
High in all of that sugar, it's fine.
Some fun cake facts. The world's tallest cake,
I'm going to say 12 metres tall.
33 metres tall, according to the Guinness World Records in Indonesia in 2008. It weighed 20 tonnes. Used 1,620 kilograms of margarine and 3,240 kilos of eggs.
Jeez.
And the world's largest cake sculpture was made in Italy in 2015. It was 123.9 metres cubed. The majority of it, it's actually really thin. And the world's most expensive cakes is a really fun thing to look up. In 2013, there was a cake made for the National Gay Wedding Show in Liverpool. You know us gays, we love a big cake.
We did it.
5 foot tall. It had 2,000 diamonds in it and was worth $52 million.
And nobody bought it because it's the tackiest thing in the world ever.
Even for gays.
Diamonds in a cake.
Yeah. Do you want to know what the bakery was called that designed it?
Douchebag Designs.
They were called Cake.
I think it was a front by Chris Morris. That's what that was.
Well, they were the most expensive cake in the world for about a year. And then in 2014, in UAE, in 2014, a guy spent $75 million on a 6 foot long birthday cake for his daughter. And the whole design of it was like a runway. And so it was a fashion show with models walking up and down the runway and people sitting alongside it, little fondant people. And it was designed by a lady called Debbie Wingham. And the majority of the expense is because of all the jewels that she encrusted onto the figurines. The cake looks shit. The figurines are really rubbish little fondant molded figures. We'll post a picture of it when the podcast goes out, but they're, for you sort of think world's most expensive cake is going to be massive.
Beautiful and elegant.
Yeah, if you've ever seen a picture of Liza Minnelli and David Guest's wedding cake, it costs about $45,000 apparently, and it's sort of big tiers and flowers hanging off, and it's red and black, and it looks a bit manky, but you sort of go, you could conceivably believe if someone said that was the world's most expensive wedding cake, whereas this, you go, really?
Also,
it's barely a showstopper.
Like, £45,000 is obviously too much for a cake, but it's...
Yeah.
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 But it's...
I mean, unless you want to pay me £45,000. That's fine.
You are...
I'll do 40. It's fine. I'll give you the...
Strong haggling skills. You're still pitching to the wrong man.
No, you're pulling yourself down.
Yeah. But the difference, like 40k for a cake is disgraceful. But if you were a multi-millionaire, sure, I can sort of see it happening. Hmm. But 75 million
yeah,
quid?
Yeah.
That is a cake that is worth... almost one Gareth Bale. That's... and I don't think its record at assists is going to be nearly as good.
One last fun recipe I found. Oh, a fellow Bake Off winner of yours. You know what Francis did last year? Francis Quinn?
Now, it will be something decorated for something, probably.
She constructed or was involved in baking along with the Hamilton Bakery in Nottinghamshire, the world's largest Jaffa cake.
Oh yes, I did know about that, yeah.
It's not a cake, it's a biscuit!
It's a cake!
So do you know why it's a cake?
Because it's got the word cake in its
name. No. So there's an actual legal definition of what is cake, and it's an obvious thing. So if you took this biscuit and let that go stale, it'll go soft. Mm-hmm. If you let cake go stale, it goes hard. And so that's literally how they tested if it would have VAT applied to it or not, by letting it go stale and see what happens
to it. So if something goes hard, it needs to have VAT applied to it.
That is the legal definition for VAT for cakes.
Oh, okay, right. Cakes. With an A sound in it.
I mean, my wife's got a backlog to pay for.
She made a Jaffa cake that was 4 foot in diameter, 23 times bigger than your average Jaffa cake.
I can beat that. It's fine.
Apparently the previous record was 3 foot, so they just went, well, add another foot to it.
I just don't see the point.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
just make them small.
Can say you've done
tasty.
It. Yeah. I mean, the whole packet is.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's a
enough.
Nice little portion. It's fine.
The whole packet is a nice little portion. Packet is a portion. I should tell you my pick. My pick for the world's worst baker is a man called Thomas Farriner.
Okay.
Do you know who Thomas Farriner is?
Yes.
Oh,
I do.
You've got him written down as well. This is exciting. You're going to have to pick someone else. I got there first. Thomas Farriner, as Ed will know, and you're about to know, is the man who started, if you like, the Great Fire of London.
Aha.
2nd of September, 1666, a fire started in his bakery, which is on what street, Ben?
Pudding Lane.
No, it's not.
Damn.
It was in a place called Fish Yard, which is now on Monument Street, just off Pudding Lane, apparently. But Pudding Lane is much more memorable than Fish Yard.
And it fits the story.
It really does,
He was a very respected man, apparently. Respected baker. He married several children. He was a member of the guild, and he supplied biscuits to the Royal Navy. The Second Anglo-Dutch War was on at the time, and he was one of the suppliers of biscuit. But it seems like maybe one night he didn't remember to douse all his fires properly and was storing some fuel next to an oven for the next day's work, which caught alight. The family escaped via an upstairs window after the blaze started, but their maid did not. I imagine the family climbing on top of the maid's shoulders to get out the window with the roof and shoving her back down unnecessarily.
Yeah, get back in there, you're dispensable.
And the fire, I mean, they said the fire took a few days to put out officially, but it was actually still burning for months afterwards. Yeah. Right? Yeah, there was still smoke in cellars and
for months.
It spread so. I mean, the city was so flammable.
It was being in the middle of like a year long drought.
Yeah,
and so literally all the buildings were wood, so it was like tinder, like a city.
Of beds
tinder.
Of straw.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Things, pillows stuffed with straw, and it was just everything was was the most burnable stuff you could imagine. Apparently, about 80% of the city, the city of London, was destroyed in the fire.
Gosh, and it was conveniently though, it was the year after the Great Plague.
Yeah, I mean, that did help.
Which is an astonishing piece of historical narrative.
Yes, just cleared it all out beautifully. But, of course, everyone cast around to look for someone to blame. So they're blaming, was it the Dutch, who there was the French, was it the Irish? Because, you know, we love a fire. We love a fire. And they actually hanged a man called Robert Hubert, who was who confessed. He was he'd arrived in Britain 2 days after the fire started.
Yeah,
and confessed. So they think possibly he wasn't of completely sound mind. But he was definitely scapegoated for the whole thing, and he was, I mean, he was unfortunate enough that the jury had three members of the Farriner family on it, and they were very keen to throw suspicion and blame into other quarters. And the whole story is that obviously there weren't that many people killed in the fire, so sort of say between 4, 5, 6 people. I've read a few articles where people say it's probably much more. They look at the leap in the ages of deaths of people in neighbouring parishes, and suddenly the age has jumped by 12 years in one parish alone, because obviously older people more susceptible to fumes and unable to escape from things. And the number of deaths in some areas definitely did jump, and this is, I'd say, after the plague. Thomas Farriner went back to work after that. He carried on being a baker for another 4 years, died in 1670. And there was a plaque erected where his shop was, basically blaming the Catholics for the fire.
Yeah.
Which they then took down about 100 years later. But for a long time, it was like, definitely the Catholics, definitely not Thomas Farriner for getting to put out a fire in an oven. Definitely wasn't my fault.
Yeah, not a forgetful Anglican. No.
He had a run-in with the law when he was a kid. He ran away from his master.
Multiple times, apparently.
But he was chucked into the Bridewell prison, which was basically like a borstal at the time for kids, boys who tried to run away and tried to reform them. Then he rose to be a respected member of society.
He's a baker, of course he rose.
So you may not have heard of my candidate.
Okay.
He's a really interesting unknown person called Thomas Farriner.
Good Lord. I mean, that's such a coincidence that he's got the same name as...
I know. And the one thing I did want to say is that one of my lines that I loved about the fire was the Lord Mayor, because it was partly the Lord Mayor's fault, because he basically was responsible for setting this ring. And so when there was a fire, they were supposed to knock down buildings so that the fire couldn't get any further. And he said... Pish, a woman could piss it out.
Yeah.
Clearly not, because it went on for months.
Yeah. I mean, the early modern fire brigade had a very unusual method. Come on, Margaret.
Could you imagine them pouring the contents of the Thames into that woman's mouth? Going, more.
Like you were saying about the blaming on foreigners, because of the war that they're in with the
foreigners,
Dutch and
not
the
foreigners.
French, foreigners. It actually led to lynchings in the street, to street violence, straight after, which doesn't sound familiar at all of blaming foreigners for our problems.
There was a French guy beaten up in London and
they
sort of
hung
beaten to death, and they hung.
I think they hung up someone from the French embassy. Was it French or maybe Dutch embassy? They escaped to a safe house. And they strung him up from a street sign. He was saved, but he had a big blue line around his neck for a while, which his colleagues laughed at, apparently, which is great. I think it was 13,000 houses got burnt in the fire. So, but actually, Farriner also had a big part to play in the hanging of the guy they blamed, because they all signed this document that said, we blame the Catholic French people.
And we definitely thought we saw him outside our shop that day.
Oh, so Farriner's got blood on his hands as well.
100%.
Apparently, one of the things was this guy said, I threw a little bomb in through a window of the bakery. Apparently, there were no windows into the pit where the fire started. And they were like, yeah, that sounds totally believable. The Frenchman guy, I've just remembered, there was a French guy beaten up because he was carrying what people thought were fireballs, and they were tennis balls. little balls of fire. Oh, just carrying around with him.
Oh dear, that's the equivalent of someone getting shot by the police because they've got like a water pistol
or
whatever.
Or something, yeah.
Oh dear.
People were stupid back then, though.
They were stupid. Since you've come up with the same suggestion as Barry, I've got to ask, where is the worst bread or cake you have experienced?
Mm. Supermarkets. Yeah. Supermarket bread is disgusting because it's made too quickly. So bread has to rise slowly. That's where it gets its flavour from. But it's also why we can digest it. So when a lot of people tell you, I'm gluten intolerant, not really. It just means they're eating so much crappy processed bread that their bodies can't deal with it. And that's why if you smell a bag, if you open a white loaf of bread and smell it, it will smell of vinegar first, not of yeast or bread or all those kind of flavours, because it's processed so quickly, they force it to rise so quickly. It doesn't have the same texture, the same flavour, the same taste, so it's grim. And I have nothing against like white bread or any of that kind of stuff. It's just that the more processed the white bread is, the grimmer it tastes and the worse for you it actually is. So an American white bread's even worse because they have something, I'm going to forget its name now.
Which honestly, I might be about to speak about.
Ah, well, I will not talk about it.
Is it nitrogen trichloride?
No, it's not. Oh.
That's not what I was going to talk about either. But it's banned everywhere else in the world apart from America. So that's why their white bread tastes even worse than ours.
You've just reminded me of something because I was looking at another similar period to the Great Fire of London. I was looking at ergotism. Such as one of the reasons people think witchcraft was so common back in the day. It's a fungus that grows on particularly on rye and other cereals as well, which has the symptoms of convulsions, mania, paresthesia, which is like itching and tingling and pricking, like the pricking of my thumbs, and as well as a sort of a dry gangrene. And there were so many outbreaks, there were a lot of outbreaks across medieval Europe, and people think that it's one of the reasons that people would suggest possessions or witchcraft. There's the famous dancing plague of 1518, you've heard this?
Vaguely.
So in Strasbourg, about 400 people danced for about a month. And they reckon it was because of a batch of ergot-infused bread.
Are you sure?
15 of them died by heart attack, stroke, or exhaustion.
God, you sure it wasn't just
15 a day, excuse me.
A really early batch of ecstasy.
Well, that's because it's LSE. Was it's essentially LSE, LSD, rather, sorry. LSE. It's not the LSE. It's not the London School of Economics.
LSE just turns you into a massive dancer.
Yeah. All those accountants just really want to dance. It's essentially LSD. There was an outbreak in France in a place called Pont-Saint-Esprit in 1951 in the south of France. 250 people were poisoned. 50 of them were put into asylums. 7 of them died.
God.
And it's not fully known why, but one theory is that the CIA were testing out LSD as a sort of a mind control drug and just picked this random
just
French village
in the middle
to do
of France.
It. The more likely suggestion is that a baker who came very close to being my favourite, my choice, a guy called Roche Briand, baked some bread from rye flour. But apparently, so I was reading it, this guy called, this is why this came to me, this guy Stephen Kaplan wrote a thing saying that at the time the French government had a big control on the supply of flour and they just gave you the flour that you had to use. So he really had no choice over, he was just delivered this and it didn't matter if it was bad or not, he just had to use it. And this guy Kaplan argues that the poisoning might have been caused by nitrogen trichloride, which is used to bleach flour to make it that shiny, pearly white bread. So he has this big bugbear about, as you're saying, like commercial flours and commercial white bread being really, really bad for you.
It's
that's
really
why,
bad
that's
for
what we're
gut.
Actually intolerant to.
Yeah, we can't digest the bread quickly because when you make it slowly, the proteins in the bread break down, so your stomachs and your systems can break the bread down. Whereas if you make a bread really quickly, you can't. So that's why you get that heavy feeling. That's why you don't feel very well. Mm. So actually, even people who have a fairly decent wheat allergy can have sourdough bread because it's done for such a long time.
Mm. What's the weirdest cake you've ever been asked to make? What's the weirdest cake you've ever been asked to make?
So there's we have a family recipe which is really weird sounding, and it's called sad cake. Yeah, but it's not actually.
Sounds like an insult.
So we didn't invent
cake.
It. No, literally, it's not our invention. It's something from where my mum grew up. So she's from Lancashire. And it's kind of, we think it's quite an old recipe. I once had to make it on the Alan Titchmarsh show dressed like I was from downstairs on Downton Abbey, because we were promoting Downton Abbey. It doesn't exist as a picture, Barry, so you can't find it on the internet.
Oh, I was just about to Google.
but basically, it's leftover pastry with currants in it and a tiny bit of sugar. So it's quite savoury, but it's really tasty. But it has the worst name.
So it's kind of like the left, it's like it's what you
yeah, it's
you
all meant to be leftovers. It's a peasant
dish. On the day after Christmas.
Yeah, totally.
Sort of thing,
and people would spread it if they had a little bit of butter and some cheese on it. It's kind of like an Eccles cake, but just not as nice as an Eccles cake. Sure. One of my most hated things, recipe wise, and I'm going to this place to work soon, so I have to be careful, is a Bakewell pudding. Not a Bakewell tart. Yeah. I love a Bakewell tart, but Bakewell pudding is this weird, greasy, fatty thing, and it's just so grim. It's not nice, but I think it's one of those things invented mainly to sell to tourists, because I don't know anyone who would want to eat that on a regular basis. It's awful. If you put it in a paper bag, within about a second, it's covered in grease. It's just, which sometimes says tasty, most of the time says, no, not for me.
Grim indeed. Okay, well, two suggestions for Thomas Barron.
First time it's happening, whatever, how many.
Does that mean we
recorded?
Automatically win?
I think, well, I think Ben gets to decide.
We will see, my friend. But yeah, this is, we've recorded over 30 now. That's the first time we've had a clash. But don't worry, guys, because I got some shit that's going to knock Thomas Farriner into a cocked hat. If you want to lose 8 hours online, type worst cake designs into Google image search. You'll have a lovely time. Some of the best worst ones I found was a wedding cake with the words "Till death us do part" on the front of it, and the severed heads of the bride and groom reproduced in cake form. There was another real slapdash one in which someone had just iced the words, "It's 10:30, I'm tired, here's your fucking cake." There were so many chocolate turds. But my favourite one was just a very uninspiring looking wedding cake, and on top of it were two taxidermied squirrels dressed as husband and wife.
Your cake was quite nice. The cake toppers on your cake were lovely.
Yeah, no, they were really sweet.
Not dead squirrels.
Not dead squirrels.
That's probably a good idea.
They were a very good likeness, actually, because a lot of cake toppers just look like...
the same person.
The same, yeah. They just look like the same basic person, but your guys actually looked like you and your...
So my wife did that really well. It looked really nice. It had me wearing a kilt and her nicking my hat, which is how we met. And our mate Jamie, who is our celebrant, he... sent us some suspicious messages a few months before we got married, going, "I would like pictures of your head, please, front, back, and both sides." Why? No reason. And then he presented to us some slightly bigger cake toppers. And I looked sort of all right, and my wife looked sort of like my wife, but on Jamie's version, she had an incredible rack. obviously, large fan of all of my wife's body. I'm a large fan of all of my wife. But that cake topper, it was just... She was defying gravity. It was insane.
I have our cake topper here, because our cake didn't have cake toppers, and then we got the little Lego versions of ourselves.
That's cute.
Pop on top. Which was nice, because then everyone at the wedding had was given a little Lego figure as one of the favours.
Nice.
And several of people just... made a Lego army on the faces of the tiers below the top tier.
Thing
of the
is, your Lego cake topper, both of you are dressed as Han Solo.
We're both dressed in fairly similar colours to what we wore at the wedding, actually. Which was although my husband is not wearing a tie in his one, because he isn't a fan
super casual
of dressing up.
Slapdash.
Smart cash.
I did uncover some naughty goings on in Subway. This might be the chemical you were talking about. Apparently they've stopped putting this chemical in since 2014 for fans of fucking awful sandwiches. It's called azodicarbonamide.
That's the one that's banned most places in the world.
You will also find that chemical in such things as yoga mats.
Nothing to do with me.
We've cracked him.
And basically, it is used in over 500 different items to give elasticity.
Yeah.
So it's to give the bread extra stretch.
To give it spring.
So it can hold itself up whilst they prove it too quickly. Otherwise, it would collapse on itself.
Oh.
I think. I may be right.
That sounds about right. And also, for extra
fun... It's like sticking elastic into it, just to...
Well, it's made of a plastic, so yeah, it's the same kind of thing. It's in plastic products quite often, or things that have like a spongy texture.
And guess what's in plastics? Full of carcinogens. So you're better off. If you have a Subway, you may as well stick it in your mouth, light it and smoke it for all the good it's doing for you. Two other things to talk about before we get onto my main suggestion. Fresher Bakeries / Harvest Time. They're a bunch of bastards. They sent two workers at their bakery into their oven to clean it without turning it off and letting it cool down properly. And they, I think it's in it's either the UK or the US, I'm not sure. It would have been more perfect for our purposes if they had baked the men and then put them into the bread. Just like, there's just a tiny 400 gram loaf with an entire man sticking out of it.
Like a foot and a half arm out each side.
Yeah. I mean, two guys died, we shouldn't laugh so much.
No, we shouldn't.
But it is hilarious.
You did remind me of the Asher Bakery as well, which is the one in Northern Ireland who got sued for not baking a gay wedding cake.
I remembered them, but I read a story of Ben Carson.
Yes, I've seen this story.
Who said that there was...
Inexplicably, the Housing and Urban Development Secretary and President Farage.
And also, inexplicably, as a genuine neurosurgeon, a fucking creationist. Anyway, world's worst neurosurgeon. Done. Yeah. But he said that the real danger with asking cake shops to make cakes for gay weddings is that they might poison them.
Letting bigoted bakers not bake cakes for gay people was really a pro-gay law.
Sure, of course
preventing,
it was. Yeah.
By preventing poisoning, yeah.
I mean, in Ben Carson land, that does make total sense.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing that... I mean, I'm going... This is off topic now, guys. The thing that gets me as a black American man...
Yeah. Barry, you're not a black American man.
The thing that gets me about Ben Carson, that black American man, is that he thinks it's... He's in the same sentence, basically, as he said that. He said, but why would you want to go into a shop where they don't want to make a cake for you when you could go to the cake down the road and get a cake from them instead? From a man who grew up... Yeah. When segregation was still a thing, to think that that is an acceptable thing to say absolutely infuriates me.
But then he...
I'm imagining everyone at home is now standing up by their the movement starts here.
It's your captain, my captain moment.
I am basically Martin Luther King Jr. Jr.
Of cakes.
Of cakes.
I have two stories to tell you. One also takes place in Texas. So I spent a lot of my time looking at poison and poisoners. So, on the 22nd of April, 1847, in Texas, in Shelby County, there was a wedding took place. The bride was an orphan. She was raised by old Mr. Wilkinson, the hog thief.
What? When is this?
1847.
I thought you said 1947. No. I didn't realise hog thief was a profession.
It's not a profession.
Yeah. It's a title. It's an honour.
Yeah.
Old Mr. Wilkinson, as opposed to young Mr. Wilkinson.
Yeah, over here we have, like, Duke and Earl. There we have hog thief and sister fucker. Anyway, she fell in love with a guy. It wasn't that impressive, but it was probably the best she was going to do at the time. So Mr. Wilkinson insisted on a quick marriage. Meanwhile, Mrs. Edens cooks some cakes, leaves them in the smokehouse overnight. You know, just hang out, be cakes. have a cake party. The next morning, someone comes down. The icing has been mysteriously removed from all of them, apart from one, which has had custard remaining on it. She doesn't have time to think about that rebate cake, so she just ices them up and puts them out for dinner. Meanwhile, there is another guy in the town called Spotswood Sanders. Great name.
All the good names.
Yeah. Sanders and Wilkinson have been feuding and fighting, as hillbillies will be.
was he a hog owner?
As part of the Regulator-Modulator Wars of...
The famous wars.
Yeah. I feel like there were more important wars in America in the 1800s.
I can't think of any.
This was like an amuse-bouche to the Civil War. And so, but to show good faith, old man Wilkinson invited Sanders and his family to the feast to end the feud. But Sanders refuses to go. So Wilkinson goes, okay, and sends some food to them. The next day, Spotswood's wife and his two children die. And the only way that Spotswood and another member's family don't die is because they manage to crawl to the well and drink as much water as possible and vomit up the poison.
Whoa.
Then, inexplicably, and no one knows why, tens of people from the wedding party die. And it was old man Wilkinson who had poisoned all of the cakes. And it's known as the Great Poison Wedding. And
why? Why did he poison everybody?
We don't know.
He wanted all their hogs.
I guess so. But if you go to...
He's just streamlining his process.
Weird. If you go to a cemetery, I think it's in East Hamilton in Shelby County in Texas, there are loads of unmarked graves who are victims of the Great Wedding Cake Poisoning.
How many people?
50 or 60.
Whoa. And the members of that family.
And the members
of
that other family. But that guy is not the world's worst baker.
Wow. I mean, that sounds straight out of Game of Thrones.
It is, yeah. Well, it's proper Campbell's and McGregor's.
Well, did they have a cake at the Red Wedding?
They didn't get around to that.
Did they not get there?
No. I think they murdered him just at the coffee course before they get onto the cake.
Liza Minnelli and David Guest took it. Yeah.
But I am going to take you back to the years post-World War II. And I'm going to tell you about an organisation who at first you'd think I'd like. They're called the NOCMIM. And the NOCMIM have a different name. They're called the Jewish Avengers.
Da-da-da! Because I don't know the theme tune to the Avengers.
So, at their lead is a guy called Abba Kovner and Vitka Kempner. They are both Lithuanian Jews, and they joined up with about 60 other men, some of whom are members of the Jewish Brigade in British Palestine, and they went around assassinating Nazi war criminals.
Whoa! Like around Europe?
Like around Europe, yeah. So Nokmim means revenge. Their full name is Dan Yehudi Nakem, which means Jewish blood revenged. And they basically wanted
it
to go.
It does exactly what it says in the tin.
It really, yeah, absolutely does. If you take it off the shelf, go, yep, all right, that'll do.
Sorry, it's Ron Seal. Does exactly what it says in the tin.
Rons.
What's
it
Ron?
Rons.
I mean, it doesn't do exactly what it says in the tin unless Ron is.
Gosh, I don't know. Either, unless, you know, there's a guy called Ron who's just not been able to speak for the past 30 years.
Nokmim, much better at branding than Ron Seal.
Yeah, they're really bang on. So they had the approval of the Israeli president to do some but not all of these actions. So here was their plan.
Just don't tell me about it, okay, guys?
I mean, that's still Israeli government policy today, to be honest. But anyway, their plan was they wanted to poison 300 loaves of bread for former SS officers who were in a US POW camp known as Stalag 13. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that they would poison them and get revenge. They then decided what they would do is that that was actually to conceal a bigger plan. That was going to be a distraction. Their bigger plan was to poison the water supply in Munich, Berlin, Weimar, Nuremberg and Hamburg. Ooh. In order to try and kill 6 million Germans.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and they've got a... I mean, what a comeback that would have been for the Jews in the second half.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool and Istanbul
Liverpool
be damned.
There's nothing on that.
But yeah, and they did say apparently, they're like, no, we're going to take care to make sure that we stay out of like American controlled towns in Western Germany. It's like, you can't be that precise.
It's not how water works.
It doesn't tell the water supply works at all.
Yeah. Thankfully, the British Secret Service uncovered this plot, but before the British Secret Service could grab the poisoners were on a boat with the poison and threw it overboard, presumably ruining North Sea fish stocks for months to come. But they did succeed in the bread pan. The bread plan. They did succeed. They made 2,283 POWs ill, 207 very ill, and 300 to 400 died. You think, except...
Oh, they didn't just have Nazis in there, did they?
No, sadly, it's not that. An Associated Press investigation in 2016 looked into it and revealed that actually no one had died. They had not killed a single Nazi in revenge because they had spread the poison too thinly, and so the arsenic was not able to become activated in the baking process. They've done the equivalent of those supermarket dickheads and not letting the arsenic prove properly.
So they just spread a story that they'd killed so many hundreds of people, and then like, no, actually, they're all fine. They all lived.
Yeah, well, I think because they presumed that they did it.
Oh, so they just guesstimated what the effect would be.
It's either that or they were trying to cover up that they didn't succeed.
That's
in any way.
Bonkers.
So they're not just good bad bakers, they're also bad liars.
They're bad liars.
Bad poisoners.
Bad poisoners. And they, I admire their firmness of purpose, but they're the world's worst bakers for A, wanting to kill 6 million Germans, and also B, for you know, talking big that they were going to kill Nazis with bread, which, as someone who adores bread and hates Nazis, that feels like sweet justice.
Get that sentence right.
Yeah.
Because whatever about liking Nazis, Ben, a lot of people like bread, and you don't want to anger those folks.
Mate, I mess up that sentence, I'm not allowed home for Passover anymore. So, I've sort of got a choice of two. Of either the Jewish Avengers or Thomas Farriner, unless, Ed, you want to dob in someone from the Bake Off.
The only thing I could think of was, so the Tartatan sisters, well, not called the Tartatan sisters, called the Tartan sisters. I love the fact that they are clearly not very good bakers because they made this thing by mistake by dropping apple tarts on the floor. But I really like apple tartatans.
That was invented by accident.
That was it was definitely invented by accident.
Yeah.
But one of the stories is that they dropped a tart on the floor and then they needed to serve it because they had guests there, so they just picked it up and served it upside down. But they invented something really tasty. So
is that how upside down cake got made as well?
Very possibly. Like, there's a whole raft of things invented by mistake in the food world.
An apple pie. It was Isaac Newton was sitting under a tree with an empty pie until an apple fell.
Well, and also Jesus, like, penicillin was invented by accident.
By Jesus.
By Jesus, yeah.
Everything was invented by Jesus, Barry?
I think you're fine, guys. Ben Carson here on our show.
It's not often that I go for my own choice, but I'm pretty tempted to because Do you know what? We don't know how good a baker Farriner was. Like, he was negligent.
He was clearly a decent baker, actually.
Exactly, particularly because he could go back and keep baking again after the Great Fire happened.
Successful.
He wasn't a great human being, particularly because he let someone else hang for him, but I reckon he served decent baked goods. He was, you know, he'd have failed a health and safety risk assessment. But Nottingham's baking...
As many people would have back then. They were cutting flour with sawdust and...
God, of course.
Yeah, plaster of Paris by the 19th century as well.
But Knock Mim, I mean, they've carried on in a Jewish tradition of being... of baking things poorly and too quickly, moving on from Passover. And they missed an open goal. They had a chance to kill a lot of Nazis and they didn't. I'm not generally a violent man, but I do like Nazis getting killed. And so because they've not just let me down, but they've let the whole Judaic faith down.
You've not let yourselves down.
Yeah.
You've let Ben down and you've let the bread down.
Yeah, that's it. They didn't put the yeast in. Yeah. That's the second yeast joke. The nice thing with yeast jokes is you can resurrect them because they'll rise again.
I was going to say, in the middle yeast.
I'm just going to leave, guys.
Yeah. I've got places to be.
Okay, before we go and shrive Barry of his terrible puns, it's time to tell you the worst news of the week. This news comes to you from Western Australia. The Kalgoorlie miners have announced the victor in their hunt for the best mullet. And the winner is Jack Jacobs. Brilliantly, the prize for having the best mullet is a hair care package. And it's there's a reasonable amount of business at the side and way too much pleasure at the back. It is the longest mullet I've ever seen, and he should not be proud of that.
Oh, the Kalgoorlie miners. Who came second?
All the other miners. So, Ed, before we go our separate ways, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
I am at The Boy Who Bakes on all social media, and my podcast is Stir the Pot. And all my cookbooks are everywhere. So, but Stir the Pot, because this is a podcast, and you need to go and listen.
Yes,
that's the way podcasts work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Subscribe to them. When you've listened to ours, first of all, give us 5 stars. Then go over to Ed's one, listen to his, give him 5 stars.
Yeah, please, bang idea.
Please.
And I believe that you're... Don't sound too desperate, mate. I believe that your next recipe is going to be for some arsenic bagels.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure they'll sell very well in North London.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's a diet aid. It's a diet aid. It's fine.
It will be.
Run right through you.
Well, we're all off to go and find a flammable bit of borough.
I've got the inbred.
Oh, man. Until next time, sorry for the puns. See you next week.
Bye.
I meant the buns. Sorry for the buns.
God, get out. Get out.
So delighted that my shit Jewish Secret Service won.
Ben, we've just noticed that Ben has won the last few episodes in a row, which is a worrying trend. I think I had built up a quite healthy lead in terms of episodes won, but he's making a strong comeback late in the day, obviously to be undone by Stan Collymore in the 91st minute.
This podcast is over, go fuck yourself. We're done.
Mentioning that particular football match between my football team and his football team from the mid-90s is still a sore point 22 years later.
I mean, this will be baffling to a lot of listeners who aren't British, but the worst thing about that is that the following year, Barry's football team were winning 3-0 with 5 minutes to go, and then my football team brought it back to 3-3 with no minutes to go, and then we still fucking lost 4-3 because I support the worst football team in the world.
That was all I needed. He's cracked at last.
Motherfucker.
Genuinely, Ben was standing shaking a chair at me during that. Oh. Anyway, thank you very much, Ed, Kimber, for joining us. And I cannot believe you picked your stupid, non-effective assassins over the fact that both of us had picked the guy who started the Great Fire of London who actually managed to kill some people.
I'm struggling to really care anymore.
Oh, babe. Did's all right. Didums. Yes, check out Ed. He's on Twitter. Go to The Boy Who Bakes, his website. Check out his podcast, all of that stuff. Also, as ever, we would love you to give us your usual love and affection and ratings and reviews on iTunes or Stitcher or Podworld or Podbean or Libsyn or Podulator. I'm just making up potential podcast host sites. Wherever you listen to us, send us some love and affection and tell the world how much you enjoy / tolerate us on your daily commute.
If you want to get in touch with us to send us advice or questions or recommendations or gifts of that fucking Stan Collymore goal, you can get us on Twitter on @worstfoot. Our email is worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. I'm on @BenVanderveld and he is on @BazMacStay. And one last thing, it's my last chance to plug it. It's the last week of the Edinburgh Fringe, so if you want to see either a potentially awards-nominated show or a broken man with a 3,000-yard stare, come and watch the human zoo of my show. It's called Sidekick. It's at 8:45 in the Pravda Room of Espionage. Bring money.
And as Ben mentioned last week, if you do mention the podcast to him, he will escort you to his favourite fudge shop and buy you the cheapest fudge available. If, on the other hand, you go up to him and mention Stan Collymore, I will bring you out for a 3-course meal in McDonald's. Each course will be the same. Next week on the podcast, we are joined by the excellent Tom Crowley to talk about the world's worst remakes. There are feature bad attempts at sitcoms, worse attempts at movies, and the odd attempt at regeneration. We are both terrible Doctor Who's. We're Doctor Wise.